Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
All right, let's get into it.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us for part two of our conversation with Jonathan McFadden on his chapter in the Content Operations book. All right, let's get back into it. The way that I've always thought about this is that you work for the customer in the context of the business.
Absolutely.
Like, there's no doubt that like the business has to organize in such a way where it has its own set of needs, because those needs become what provide for the people who can work for the customer. But at the end of the day, people who are in the business should be, by and large, you know, maybe there's like, maybe the CFO really works for the business, but like, you know, the majority of the people, 99% of the people in the business really work for the customer. So I think that's, in this context of content, you know, what you said is very, very valid.
Absolutely. And I mean, we all know that with no customer, there is no business, right? There is no revenue. There are no profit margins. There is no high, like, inflated stock price. All of these things are completely reliant on the people who use our products and services. So if we don't, I think, keep them at the forefront of our minds, then what are we even doing? Like, what kind of success are we actually hoping to attain? And how much there won't be any longevity to the business, right? The business will utterly collapse because we're not serving the people who actually feed the business. My view is absolutely right. Like, the business is like the container. It is the enclosure in which we do our work, but it's not the reason that we do our work. It's not what drives us. It's not what fuels our decision-making, hopefully. Not the only solitary thing that does, at the very least. Hopefully we are committed to the human experience and to what real people are dealing with and experiencing and kind of interacting with every single day when we are building these products and shipping new features and creating new componentry and making these decisions. They have real life implications. They affect real people. And those people, depending on what their experience is like, will either commit even more to the thing we're making, which helps the business, or they're going to jump ship. And no business wants that. So it behooves us.
Taking that idea of like the human aspect of this, one of the things that I took away from your chapter is that it felt to me that your prescription for how to get to the value as a human had a lot to do with the type of teams that you wanted to think about putting together to create this value. So I was hoping you could go a little bit more into how you think about that.
Yeah. It was about or around this time when I was writing this chapter that I was also preparing for a presentation at a conference on a very similar topic. And my contention, I guess I started formalizing this in 2022. My contention now is that, like, guidelines and instruction manuals and prescriptions for inclusive content and humane content, those are great. Like, we need those. We need something codified that says, this is our point of view on how to create an inclusive experience. And these are the things we do. And these are all the factors that kind of work together to ensure that we are creating and building humane products. But I can't help but call foul just a bit when the people who are creating those guidelines, by and large, all look the same and have very similar life experiences. Now, when we talk about diversity, like, that is, it's a wide berth, right? Like, there is a lot that you can talk about. There's race, there's gender, there's language, there's geography, there's professional diversity. There's education, I can continue to rattle on. But I think just from an optics point of view, a lot of what I've seen is that, okay, such and such company will release this lengthy kind of like robust volume of inclusive language guidelines, but every single person who's involved in the creation of those guidelines is white, is a white man. And so it kind of feels, I don't want to go as far as to say it feels hypocritical. It just feels like we are talking out of two sides of our neck. We're saying one thing, but practicing something very differently. And so how can we ensure that we're actually building like inclusive experiences if by and large our teams are homogenous? If they are the complete opposite of inclusive, they're actually quite exclusive and quite elitist. And so we have these guidelines, we have these people who say like, this is what we do and this is how we create this really open and fair and equitable experience, when we've created these humongous barriers to entry for people who want to even enter into this space, who want to practice this work. Again, it kind of feels like what do we actually believe? Like, what is our actual point of view? Because I hold that in order to create a truly inclusive and diverse experience, it is more beneficial to have a truly open, inclusive, and diverse team of people who can bring the context of their life experiences, of how they exist in the world today, how they maneuver life today, into that process, so that at the very least, we are ensuring that we're not creating something that perpetuates more harm. Because even in our use, even if our intentions are good, we can inadvertently miss something, or we can inadvertently create something that just causes a lot of harm, that just continues to perpetuate some of the same systemic biases that we proclaim we're trying to actually, you know, reverse. We're trying to actually dismantle. And when in fact, we're actually ensuring its vitality and its perpetuity. And so I think we have to be as invested in creating diverse teams of people who actually make the things, just as invested in that part of the process as we are in actually creating all these guidelines for people to read and ooh and ah at, and then implement and execute. I think there is in a lot of teams and a lot of design organizations, that's a huge missing piece of the puzzle.
Right.
We have the guidelines, we have the rule book, but when you actually take a close look at who's actually coming up with the rules, we are still upholding power differentials. We are still upholding, a very clear commitment to systemic bias. We're still saying, oh, it's only these people who get to do this thing. You can't be a part of this. So like, if we're going to be in, let's be in. Mm-hmm. If we're going to do this, let's do it the right way, the full way. Let's go all in. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, this is no different than trying to accomplish anything else. You know, if you want a team to put something out, that team has to be made up of the right people.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I mean, like, if you want a really good baseball team, you got to have really good baseball players, right? If the output is great baseball, I don't even watch baseball. I don't know why I chose baseball. But if the output is that you're looking for is inclusivity and attention to, you know, different groups of individuals, like, I just don't see how you do that without a team that represents that, right? Like, you have to have the right people to produce the right output. So to me, it just doesn't, I don't understand how that's not obvious, I guess.
Same. It's probably one of the most sensible things, like things, right? Like, you want A, you need B to accomplish A. And it's logical. But because of implicit biases and these kind of the shortcuts that we take, and because of our commitment to comfort and our, you know, I think, there has been for such a long time, like, this organizational unwillingness to truly like talk about these, what some might call politically charged topics, that make people really uncomfortable and make people have to confront like really uncomfortable and hard truths about themselves and perhaps their own complicity in certain systems, whether they consciously have been complicit or not. It's just easier not to think about it, and it's easier not to do it. And it's easier to say things like, well, we can't really find people of color to fit this particular role. Like, we try, but we just can't find people who are qualified enough to do it. Or, you know, we thought about hiring someone over the age of 60, but we really actually, you know, we want to ensure that our teams are agile and nimble. And so we use like loaded language like that, that is ageist, that is racist at the core, and to ensure again that we are operating from the familiar, because it's easy. It's just easy. It's easy to hire somebody who has an MBA, right? It's like, oh, okay, I trust the fact. I don't know much about you. I don't know if your actual lived experience will be a benefit or value to this team, but I see on paper that you have the credentials that maybe match my credentials. And so because I connect and I resonate with, and that resonates with me, I'm going to choose you over the person who didn't even graduate college or didn't go to college, because it's just easier for me to understand you, and I can speak your language and you can speak mine, and we can talk in acronyms and we understand the numbers, and we can all, you know, never mind the fact that a lot of people, if they're starting something new, they'll learn how to do the job. Like, you can, that stuff can be learned. It's just that we have this like inherent bias that, okay, we come from a similar place, we look the same, we speak the same, so obviously we have the same amount of knowledge, and it's going to be so much easier to onboard you, and we don't have to go through that learning curve, when that may not be true at all.
Yeah, I think that those biases are part of being human.
And yeah.
Recognizing them is...
Yeah. It's so good, and which is the problem. Right, like that. One of the things I said during that conference was that people are the problem, but people are also the antidote. That's the thing. Like, we're the poison and the panacea. So we can make deliberate choice. We can think differently. We can like design, David Dylan Thomas wrote Design for Cognitive Bias, I think in 2020, I think that's when he published it, came out at just the right time, honestly. And he talks about like ways you can reprogram those biases to actually be useful in the context of a design experience, because, or a design sprint, because you can actually identify them, understand where they come from, and then find a way to solve for them. Because that's what we do, right? We solve problems. Right. That's what the job is at its core. So if we identify a bias as a problem that needs to be solved, if we treat it that way, then okay, let's go about finding a way to ideate for a solution. But again, that requires a lot of work, like internal work, and that's uncomfortable work. And it's like, well, that's not part of my job description. There's that too. Not a lot of job description. Not a lot of employers are going to give you time to sit and to really think carefully and deliberately about your biases and how that's entering, potentially affecting your work and the people who engage with it.
Yeah, not unless there's a direct profit motive. I mean, if you're just being realistic.
Absolutely.
But, and sometimes that's why you have to make a business case for it.
You
which
do.
Actually, you do a good job of what's at stake if we don't act. That's another section of your chapter. You know, I think you talk about that a little bit. I don't want to go too deeply into that right now because I want people to come and read it. And I also have a curiosity that I've had stuck in the back of my head since we first started talking that I want to get to before I ask you one more question that I've got written down here. Okay. So you said that Carlos sold you on writing this chapter, and you had some reservations. I want to know what those were.
I'm not a content ops professional. This is not my world. And so I wrestled with an extreme case of imposter syndrome because I saw the roster of authors, and I knew your pedigrees. I knew the backgrounds. I did some LinkedIn stalking. I mean, research. And I was like...
You stalk on Facebook, you research on LinkedIn.
That's right. Thank you. Context is important.
Exactly.
And so I was like, I don't fit here. I don't belong with these people, which is ironic, right?
I was just thinking that. It's a little ironic given the conversation, but okay, continue.
Exactly. Which I think goes to show just how deeply ingrained this stuff can be. Because here I am approaching this particular, you know, this project and looking at everyone around me figuratively. And I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to make this chapter actually flow with everything. Like, a lot of what they're writing is incredibly pragmatic. It's very technologically sound. It's like giving people like, do this, do that, do, like, is giving them the prescription. And I'm like, I'm going to write about DEI, which in a lot of instances is like this really lofty idea for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, it's not, I can't distill DEI into a how-to.
You kind of do a little bit, like, to be fair, I don't know.
I think a lot of this, as I started to write the chapter and kind of, you know, I had a conversation with my wife about it. I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. But as I sat down and started writing the chapter, I think that's when all that stuff started to coalesce for me. Because I found myself perpetuating a bias about DEI, despite my own passion, that a lot of times it's not taken seriously as head work as much as it's taken as heart work. And in the context of business, heart work is not as well respected as the head work. If it can't be quantifiably justified, if it can't be measured, if it doesn't have some kind of scientific foundation, it's not something we take seriously. But then I had to think deeply about that, and I had to interrogate my own issues with it. And I'm like, wait, it absolutely is scientific because it has everything to do with how we exist in the world. And that, mm-hmm. isn't that what science is? It's observation about existence when you think about it. And so I'm like, this is absolutely academic. This is absolutely important. It's vital. And so I just started writing what I felt and what I thought. And I, of course, I did research and, you know, listen, if you're going to come, you got to come correct. So I definitely wanted to validate a lot of my assumptions and validate a lot of my points and ensure that I was providing people with really solid sources. But at the same time, I wanted to write from my own experience, because mm-hmm. even though, yes, this is a book about content ops, there's a lot about governance. There's a lot about things that I don't do day in and day out. There's a lot about my experience that I think touches, and everyone's experience that is kind of like a connected thread throughout the entire book. And so it's like, okay, let's make this meaty and let's make this chunky and help people understand that, yes, at the you're doing all these things and you're getting like all of these professionals, these people I respect and these highly esteemed professionals in this space are going to give you a lot of meat and a lot of great content, and they're going to help you do the thing. I want us to zoom back a little bit and remember why we do the thing in the first place. And that's
fantastic.
Yeah, that's just as important in my
opinion. I'm super glad I asked about that. I love that answer.
Yeah.
So that's great. I just have one more question for you. You know, if there was like one thing you wanted people to take away from your chapter when they finish reading it, you know, like, what's that thing?
I think that would be, don't lose your heart. You know, when I wrote this in 2022, things were different a little bit. Like, things were starting to change in tech a little bit. The space was starting to change as far as like where we find ourselves now in the context of this layoff epidemic and, you know, this overwhelming excitement about AI. Like, that was starting, what we see now was just starting to kind of get out there. We're seeing some nuggets and some sprinkles. But things have gotten really rough for a lot of people over the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And I think it's so easy for us to probably go into survival mode. So we think a lot about the business goals because we want to make sure that we're on the right teams and that we're doing the right, that we're building the right things to ensure our own safety. And that's not a bad thing. That's self-preservation. I understand. I feel it. I am a new father. I feel it. I get it.
Congratulations.
Thank you. At the same time, like, there, what we do is so critically important in this digital age because people, again, are experiencing real life in the context of what we make. So, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, you're creating things for the internet, right? But it's not just the internet.
Yeah.
You bank online. probably. You may order food online. You may connect with family or friends online. You might meet your mate online, whatever the case may be. You're living your life in a digital community. And so we as content professionals, again, no matter your flavor, we're kind of like the custodians of the community. Like, we should be the ones who help clean up the trash, but also help keep the lawns manicured. Yeah. We want to make sure that, you know, that when you move into the neighborhood, you feel welcome. So maybe we show up at the door with a gelatin of some sort or a pound cake. To borrow from my experience as a Southerner. Or maybe we invite you out to try something new because we just want to make sure that, you know, you're part of the team. Like, you're with us. We love, maybe love is a little strong. We want you here. You're here. We want you here. Yeah. So let's make sure that you're having a really good time. Like, we're the welcome committee, but we're also the ones who are invested. Like, we're community relations. We're the ones who are invested in ensuring that your experience is a good one, because there's a lot of trash out here that could really hurt you. And we don't want to hurt you. Like, we don't want to be part of that group of people who are just making things that cause a lot of harm. So we watch the words that we use. We watch how we're building the house. We watch the architecture. We watch the blueprint, everything. We think very thoroughly about every possible interaction you can have with an object in your digital space to ensure that it is as humane and as open and welcoming as possible, because the last thing you want to do is hurt you. And so I think that is what I want people to take away from all this. No matter like the tumult we experience in tech right now, no matter how, you know, we're really getting the message that, listen, y'all are just a bunch of minions that we move around when we want to, you know, manipulate shareholder sentiment. And so that the stock price goes up. So if we have to let you go, we'll just let you go. No matter how much that happens, I want us to just remember we're needed. We're necessary. Mm-hmm. The work that we do is absolutely, especially in the age of, I don't even call it the age of AI. AI is not new. Like, it's just this obsession with this latest permutation. But in this age of ChatGPT and OpenAI's drone videos and all those kinds of things, we are still incredibly necessary, because people are going to have experiences, and the business may not understand the value that we offer in protecting people from the harm, but there will come an inflection point. There will come a moment where things get really, really, really bad. And then they're going to be like, oh, we do need people to think about this really carefully, because, oh, our chatbot accidentally, maybe inadvertently told somebody that, you actually do have to pay for this particular, like, I'm thinking about the recent thing with Air Canada.
Yeah, everybody's talking about Air Canada. That actually came up when I talked to somebody earlier today too.
Exactly. Like, we're actually going to make you pay money you don't really have to pay. Things like that. That's just the beginning. It's going to happen a lot more. And that's where we step in and we show that, hey, we have superpowers. You know, this is what we do. This is what we think about. This is what keeps us up at night. Let us take care of this. So you're still necessary. All that said, you're still necessary, because people are people. Humanity is humanity. The machines will not replace us. We are still going to be here. We're going to still occupy this space and this planet. And as long as we are still here, people like you and me who do the work that we do are necessary.
Excellent. It's a great way to end. So thank you so much for being here, Jonathan. I really appreciated you coming on and having a conversation with us. And I hope everybody enjoyed listening to us and hearing a little bit about your chapter. And they'll go and they'll check out the whole thing with the content operations book, which can be gotten through the Virginia Tech website. And we'll have some other links for it someplace in the notes when those are available. So thanks again, Jonathan. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.